Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the week of the Calcio Land podcast. So today we have a fun and informative episode for you. We have some fire game picks from Thousand Names with the Serie A weekend. It's actually starting right as we're recording. We'll do this on Thursday afternoon. We have some fantastic Twitter questions from our listeners, and we're going to close out with an interview with our friend Nima Tavalli on all the chaos going on at Inter. But before we get to that, I'm joined by our great friend, the co-host, the producer of the podcast, Alex Goldberg. And Alex, I'm going to ask you a question I asked our Twitter followers on the Calcio Land account. So, at the start of next season, who do you think has a better chance of managing their respective team? Gattuso, Spalletti? Do you expect neither of them to be coaching their teams, or both? What would be your best guess?
It's a good question, David. And my gut reaction is Gattuso. I'm going to say Gattuso. Now, it could be a cop-out by saying both, I guess, because as you always say, it's so much easier to sack a manager than replace them. So maybe that's how both clubs see it and both of them are retained. However, I do think Spalletti will probably lose his job, and I don't think Gattuso will. And I'm projecting a little bit, but here's how I see it. I think Spalletti has had an easier job than Gattuso, and the way Inter is moving right now, you would say they're underperforming, they're underachieving, because yeah, maybe saying they'd be second place this year just because of how great they looked on paper was pushing it a little bit on my part and other people's parts, but still, they're just too good to be 20 points back of Juventus, in my opinion, and that's on paper. And the way they've been playing lately is not great. And unfortunately for managers, it's really not how you start, it's how you finish. That's the way it is for many people in their professions. And then you look at Gattuso, and I would say that he's really had a difficult job. So many players have been injured, and there's been way less solidity to the overall team of Milan rather than Inter. There's been so many more question marks. The Higuain situation was not the easiest to deal with. And as I said, key players have been injured. But all of a sudden, the way he's kind of deploying someone like Bakayoko and Paqueta and Frank Kessie and now Piontek, I really think they might help him save his job and be there next season. Because at this point, I just get this vibe from Milan that things are moving in the right direction. Now, I still stand by that, even if Inter do finish a little bit ahead of Milan, because I just think Milan have a better arrow right now. And I think, unfortunately for managers, like I said, it's not really necessarily how you start. Inter had a pretty decent start first half to the season, obviously, but it really is how you finish. And a lot of the times managers, this happens in every sport, David, a lot of times managers, even that have decent seasons, lose their job once they maybe sputter at the end of the season. And it looks like Inter sputtering now. Maybe they save themselves, but I think it's way more likely Gattuso is at the helm next season rather than Spalletti, or both, or neither. That's my answer, David. How about you?
Yeah, I agree with you. That's my answer as well, for slightly different reasons. So I think right now I'm actually at the point where I think I'd be rather surprised if Gattuso isn't Milan's manager next season. And Spalletti, on the other hand, I'm not going to say very surprised, but surprised if he is. One thing that stands out to me is it looks like Spalletti in a lot of ways has lost Inter's locker room. We had Perisic demanding to leave, Miranda demanding to leave, and maybe Miranda, it's a little bit unfair to put it on Spalletti. That was more with De Vrij. There were reports of other players asking to go. That match against Bologna was really, really a poor performance from Inter, just a lack of effort. I think with Milan, when we had disappointing matches, I'm not really sure we can really say it was a lack of effort from the team. Maybe it was a lack of talent. And as you mentioned, Gattuso's pushed a lot of the right buttons. Bakayoko himself said he was a big driver of that. He's integrated Paqueta really well, and Piontek, you know, I don't want to be a prisoner at the moment, but they're off to really good starts. And the other reason that I'm going to say I'm going to go with Spalletti more likely to go, is as much as Milan's on the right path, I still think the Inter job is slightly more attractive to a big name manager. So I think it's easier to find someone better. The reason I say that, financial fair play is definitely one of it. Inter's about to get out of this. They just have to make a few sales in the summer and they're scot-free. They have ownership that can spend. They have ownership that is a long-term ownership group in theory. Milan, on the other hand, they spent a lot this January. They already had financial fair play issues. They are trying to change the agreement with UEFA a little bit, but they need to have a balanced budget within 3 years. So I think, you know, the team that they have, it's kind of hard to envision it being much different next season. While someone coming to Inter, you already have Godin coming in and potential to spend. So I'm going to go with that. And I also think, you know, Gattuso, I definitely get the complaints on the limitations on him, but you never got the sense that the team quit on him. I think, you know, when Milan had all those injuries in the fall, when Bonaventura, Biglia, Romagnoli, Musacchio all went out, I mean, we talked about it on the podcast, like it really felt like impossible that they would finish in top four with that. And I think most Milan fans, if they're honest, they would say that when that happened, they would have felt the same. So it's a bottom line business. And I think that Gattuso has done enough. So now that's my answer. So before we get to 1,000 names game picks, I'm going to ask you rapid fire. It's really changed a lot in the standings. It's really interesting what's going on. So simply put, Alex, tell me, as of right now, who do you think are going to be the top four teams in Serie A at the end of the season?
All right, rapid fire. I have Juve obviously winning the Scudetto. By the way, Juve, you're still not in a crisis. I just need to hammer that home. I have Napoli in second place, which I feel pretty comfortable with as they're still 11 points above Inter. And this one's tough for me because Inter right now is only 4 points ahead of Milan. But I do have Inter finishing third, but just barely. It's not going to be as pretty as it will be for Juve and Napoli for Inter. So fourth place, very tough. It's still wide open, but I'm a sucker for momentum. I'm an absolute sucker for momentum. And that good vibe I alluded to in the first question, David, I'm going to take Milan. Now I'd love to cheat and redo this answer once Lazio finished their game today, but no, I'm taking Milan. I'm getting a vibe about them, getting a feeling about them. This is obviously the one that's most up for grabs here with how many people are fighting over fourth place, but I'm going to say exactly the way it's standing right now. Juve, Napoli, Inter, Milan. That's what I got, David. What about you?
I'm very tempted to have the exact same order. I'm going to go Juve, Napoli. I'm going to go Milan third and Inter fourth. Very close, but I'm going to go with that. I'm going to ride the Piontek train. I'm going to, despite my reservations on him, Milan just seems like the team that, you know, has a lot of positive momentum. So as it stands now, that's how I'm going to go. You guys know I have a soft spot for Lazio. And as you said, they are about to kick off if they haven't already. But yeah, that's what I'm going to go with. So I'm almost the same as you, but I'm going to have Milan finishing 1 or 2 points above Inter. And I think it would be great for Calcio to have both in the Champions League.
Yeah, absolutely. It really would be good to see both Milans in the Champions League next year. All right, David, you've been alluding to it. You've been laughing, just referencing these picks from 1,000 Names. So we have a nice slate of Serie A ahead of us. So without further ado, what are our game picks from you and 1,000?
So first off, shout out to 1,000 Names. I don't know if you guys saw his tweet on the Adam Levine, Tancredi thing. That was pretty brilliant. And you guys that like 1,000's picks here, and I think some of you are really starting to get his sense of humor and his tendencies. If you're trying to learn Italian, I think you'll get a lot out of his account. So you guys know the drill. He picks the matches. I know ahead of time his picks. I make the picks, but he picks the matches. So some really good ones. I'm going to start with my favorite one of the week, and this is Napoli traveling to Tuscany to face Fiorentina, and he has Napoli winning 1-0, goal by Koulibaly. And he says the last season 3-0 match where Fiorentina shockingly beat Napoli is going to be vindicated when Napoli lost the Scudetto in their hotel room. And if you guys remember, this is a reference to Higuain scoring the game winner against Inter that really changed the momentum of the title. Even Cuadrado trolled Napoli a little bit when Juve visited Fiorentina. And then he says that that loss against Fiorentina last year was Orsato, the referee's fault, and that because they avenged this match, Sarri's going to video conference the team from London in tears, and the team's going to tell him that this win, this triumph is for him. In Italian, Fiorentina-Napoli 0-1, Koulibaly, vendicato il 3-0 dell'anno scorso quando il Napoli perse lo scudetto in albergo. Fu colpa di Orsato. Videoconferenza con Sarri da Londra in lacrime. Questo trionfo è per lui. So before we get to Sassuolo Juve, let me make my pick for Fiorentina Napoli. I'm going to have it 1-1. I'm going to have Muriel score another goal and Milik, my two of my favorite strikers, scoring. So next up, Juve, Reggio Emilia against Sassuolo. 1,000 has Sassuolo beating Juve 2-0. Goals by Sensi and Berardi. Ronaldo sbaglia rigore. I don't need to translate that. He says Allegri is in panic because now that Marotta's gone, teams aren't just giving up before the match starts. And now Allegri's starting to feel Inter's breath on his neck. I guess minus 17 points qualifies for 1,000. In Italian, Sassuolo, Juve 2-0, Sensi Berardi. Ronaldo sbaglia rigore, Allegri nel panico, senza Marotta non si scansano e si sente il fiato sul collo dell'Inter. I'm going to reiterate what you said, Alex. Juve is not in crisis. I've really seen a lot of prisoner of the moment articles here. I've said it. I think this has much more to do with Juve's defense, you know, being in shambles because of the injuries and Benatia leaving. I'm going to have Juve winning this match 2-0, and I'm going to have goals by Mandzukic and Dybala, who I will say, if you want to say someone's a little bit in crisis at Juve, you can pick Dybala, not the team as a whole. So Parma-Inter, 1,000 names as Inter winning 3-0. Icardi, Perisic, Brozovic. He says Spalletti's hair is going to start growing back. He gives a lesson football against the team of dogs that Allegri ended up drawing 3-3. The crisis is over. Mauro, and that's Icardi, has returned. In Italian, Parma-Inter 0-3. Icardi, Perisic, Brozovic. A Spalletti ricrescono i capelli. Lezione di calcio ad Allegri che contro questi cani ha pareggiato 3-3. La crisi è finita. Mauro è tornato. So I'm going to disagree with 1,000 once again. We have a week where all our picks are different. I'm going to have this as a 1-1 draw. Parma has been playing really well. I like that move bringing in Kuchka. I'm going to have it 1-1. I'm going to give a goal to Icardi and I'll give a goal to Inglese. I have Parma-Inter as a draw. 1,000 has Inter winning. 1,000 has Sassuolo-Juve. He has Sassuolo winning. I bet you on Twitter it'll be a different pick. And I have Fiorentina-Napoli as a draw. He has Napoli winning. And one thing that's always winning is when we receive the fantastic questions from our Twitter followers and listeners. As always, you can send us questions using the CalcioLand hashtag. And which ones are we going to go over today, Alex?
All right, David, first Twitter question. I chuckle when I read this because this has been a dramatic week, I guess. Do you think the Hamsik deal will still go through?
Yeah, I do. I think at this point, Hamsik coming back to Napoli would be really, really difficult. I think, you know, if you really read the details of why the deal didn't happen, it's not the amount of the transfer fee, it's the payment method, so the installments and how it's done. It really seems like a minor thing in the grand scheme of things. I think more than anything, this is a reminder of how you do not F with Napoli on the transfer market. They will only do things on their terms, even with a legend like Hamsik. So I'd be really surprised if it doesn't happen. Keep in mind the transfer window in China is open till the end of February. There's plenty of time. Hamsik wants to go. I think it would just look really bad. I've seen some people say, hey, could he go to another team or could he retire? I just don't see that. I think at the end of the day, this deal is going to happen. But again, this is also, I think Napoli is also sending a message to everyone else in the summer when you come for Koulibaly or Allan or whatever. Be ready because we don't play. We sell players on our terms.
Yeah, really well said there, David. You don't F with Napoli. That's why someone asked me if I think Chelsea can get Lorenzo Insigne this summer to replace Hazard. That's hilarious. Like De Laurentiis would ever let Insigne go to Sarri at Chelsea. No chance. All right, next Twitter question, David. Do you think the Storaro deal is being artificially inflated or primarily a reflection of where the market is?
I have to say, visually, this deal just looks really, really bad. If you're a Juve conspiracy theory theorist, this is like Christmas morning for you. So let's recap this. Genoa sells Piontek for $35 million. They get paid in one installment for that. They've done a bunch of minor deals. Not just Sanabria, but they've been kind of spreading that money around to make some future profits. I wasn't surprised by that. The Sturaro thing, though, was pretty surprising. So they first get him on loan and they say, you know, this loan becomes a permanent deal if certain conditions are triggered. So what happens? Sturaro doesn't even play in a match and the deal becomes automatic. The deal goes through. I've read reports that the condition for this deal to vest was that Genoa made a point in the standings, like something really that benign. So it was really like a complete technicality. So Genoa makes their most expensive purchase in their history for Sturaro, you know, a limited player. And I'm trying to be, you know, nice about it here. So that looks really bad. I definitely get it. The one thing, though, that I'll say, and I've been consistent about this, isn't just per se about Juve. I say it all the time. When you look at deals between clubs who've made multiple deals in the span of a year or two, you cannot look at them in a vacuum. You always have to look at them in the totality and look, you know, kind of all the deals and add them all up. So we've had some deals, you know, between Genoa and Juve. We had Perin, we had striker Faviglia. I think there were some other minor deals. In the summer, Genoa defender Romero, it seems almost certain he'll go to Juve. So I'm very curious to see what the figure of that deal is. Is it possible that that figure is going to look inflated, like Juve maybe is overpaying? It's very possible. Keep in mind, this is also about fiscal years and when transactions are put on the team's fiscal years. They did this Sturaro deal now. The deal for Romero could happen in the summer, different fiscal year. So there are some benefits to that. So I definitely get the outrage. I absolutely do. I think if you look at it in a vacuum, there's really no way around it. At the same time, though, you know, this isn't completely unique to Juve. Clubs that make a lot of deals with one another, some deals are head scratchers, but then you look at all of them combined and, you know, maybe they look a little bit different. So let's see what happens with Romero in the summer. That's my answer, long and short of it.
All right, David, he's back. Prisoner of the moment is back with another question. Here it is. What bargain makes more sense? Alaska for $7.2 million, Louisiana for $15 million, or Storaro for $16 million?
Yeah, I don't think I even need to answer that, but I think this really sums up the mood and the reaction on Twitter for that. So shout out to Prisoner of the Moment. He always brings it with his questions.
That he does. Amen. All right, this next question comes from Michael Abandonalo. I really hope I pronounced that correct. Thank you, Michael. He asks, knowing what you know, if you were Juve, would you rather have kept Caldara or Benatia last summer?
This is an excellent question, and it really comes down to finances. And we talked a lot about it with the Caldara deal in the summer to Milan. Like, it was really no surprise that on the press release when Juve announced that Caldara was going to Milan for the amount that he did, they put the exact amount of the plusvalenza, what they got for him. This deal had a lot to do with, you know, Juve spending so much on Ronaldo, not selling any of their big names already in the squad. They had to make up the money somewhere else. They sold Caldara for a big profit compared to what they paid for him. That made a lot of sense. Benatia in the summer, getting a big offer for him where you could make a similar profit was going to be tough. So financially, this made a lot more sense for Juve to do it that way. Like, we've talked plenty about the Benatia deal here on the podcast. I'm not going to keep beating up on Rugani and Caceres and all that. But that Caldara deal was really a financial one. If you're a Juve fan and you're like, hey, geez, we really could have used the center back, you know, maybe Caldara doesn't get hurt if he stays at Juve. But bottom line, had Juve not sold Caldara for that amount, they would have had to sell someone else, like a bigger name already on the squad. So financially, I think this made a lot of sense for Juve.
All right, David, next Twitter question. What's the update on Palermo's ownership situation?
Yeah, this has been a lot in the news. And if you guys remember, I think it was about a month or two ago, we had my friend Lorenzo Vicini come on the podcast, give us a history of Palermo, and then give us a talk on the new owners. And I put this in, you know, it's really not really new owners. This felt like, you know, a financial deal. And I always tell people, you know, for us, for me, for the people listening, for football is passion. It's something that we enjoy. But for a lot of people, it's a business. So I'm just going to read you a string of emails that our friend Lorenzo Vicini tweeted yesterday, because I mean, he knows the situation much better than I. But if you listen to that podcast a while back, I mean, I'm sure you could tell we weren't really surprised that it would go this way. So I'm just going to read this series of tweets. There's a 98% chance that my beloved Palermo will be bankrupt and have to start over from Serie D, the fourth division. It kills me. There's so many twists and turns of this whole downfall, and it goes back years. There's enough material here to make for a captivating document. There's no money. Zamparini had no money for years. The British conglomerate that led the takeover also had no money. They're gone. Emanuele Facile, the administrator, now must come up with a large sum of money within days to prevent a surefire bankruptcy. But really, it's too late. All you can do is hope that the situation is hopeless. In 9 days, a payment of $5.4 million needs to be made for wages. If that money shows up well, another two installments of $5.4 million needs to be made. 5.4 plus 5.4 plus 5.4, 16.2. But wait, let's say 16.2 miraculously shows up over the next couple of weeks. It's still not enough money. Why? Because that's just a glorified wage bill. Palermo owes $22.8 million to Alissa, the Luxembourg holding company that owns the club licensing and merchandising rights. So, hate to depress you. Enzo knows this situation much better than I. I really wasn't surprised when I saw that deal, Palermo being sold the way that it was. It seemed very, very fishy for me. This is unfortunately another club with a distinguished history that's going to have to start over from Serie D. Talked about it on the podcast. They have, you know, Jim Laggio with Padova Ultras. So I wish them all the best. I hope Palermo can come back. But look at the bright side. Parma, in 4 years from going bankrupt, made it back to Serie A, and they're doing rather well. So all the best to Palermo and their fans.
All right, David, this question comes from Tito Bocchia, and he asks, I'm a non-Italian, and I'm torn between supporting Roma or Inter. Who should I pick?
Good question. So I think, you know, you can make a case for both. Inter, you're always going to be entertained with the Pazza Inter aspect. They have some exciting players. They have a solid ownership group that's pretty ambitious. I think, you know, you can make a case that they are probably on more solid footing than Roma moving forward. Roma, on the other hand, are in a lot of ways the hip team in Serie A, you know, because of their social media team. If you wanted to go watch a game, I have nothing against the city of Milan, but the city of Rome is one of the most beautiful in the world. So I don't know. I think, you know, for strictly footballing reasons and also trophies won and all, Inter, I think for everything else, I would pick Roma. What about you, Alex? If you had to pick one of the two, which one would you go for?
Yeah, really tough question, but I really am huge on youth prospects. And David, this is one that you even love. Zaniolo right now would totally sway me to Roma's side. That kid is the real deal. So I would say Roma, but really it's wherever your heart wants to take you. That's really the answer. All right, David, let's move away from football. Where do you rank Once Upon a Time in America amongst gangster films?
So first of all, I'd love to see what kind of hashtags you'd come up with for Zaniolo. So that would be pretty cool. So back to the question on the movie. So Once Upon a Time in America is a movie with James Caan, De Niro, Sergio Leone, a very famous Italian director that did cowboy spaghetti Western movies. This was his take on the gangster film. American style. And this is about, you know, a Jewish gang in New York. Has De Niro. It's a really, really great movie. Super long, very epic. I will say this, compared to, say, Godfather, Goodfellas, Casino. And Casino, you know, is definitely more recent. I wouldn't say it's aged well at all. I think if you watch it, it definitely looks very dated. Maybe it's a little bit repetitive. It's still a classic. I definitely recommend that. If it's on TV, I'll definitely watch some of it. I'd say some things, especially in the new society that we live in, might look really in poor taste. But if you're looking for a gangster film, like you can do a lot worse. So I'll say, you know, I definitely rank it below those movies that I mentioned. A movie similar era that I think has aged better is Mean Streets. And that was Scorsese's first gangster film. That was like De Niro's kind of breakout role. It also has Harvey Keitel. I'm going to have Mean Streets slightly above that. But I think both of them would be fun to watch if you're really into like Godfather and all that.
All right. How about this, David? The book The Dirt is being made into a movie. Where do you rank Motley Crue in metal history?
When I think of Los Angeles and, you know, what band represents Los Angeles, they are definitely up there, you know, with Jane's Addiction, NWA, Red Hot Chili Peppers. They are right there. I think they represent L.A. much, much better than Guns N' Roses, in my opinion. Obviously, Guns N' Roses is a better band, and we'll get to them in a second. I think, you know, of the hair metal band, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, Motley Crue, like really, really lives up to that. Tommy Lee with Pamela Anderson, Nikki Sixx dated a bunch of models. So yeah, I think, you know, when you look at like the fun aspect of rock and roll, maybe, you know, not the best songs, but Image and all, like it's hard to do better. I will say Dr. Feelgood, one of their, I think was the last album from the 80s, to me holds up really, really well. It's one of my favorite, the way the production on the album is incredible. I still listen to it quite often at the gym. That album, the producer Bob Rock is one of the reasons Metallica kind of changed their sound in the early 90s. So very influential. So yeah, I definitely think Motley Crue deserve to be remembered as, you know, maybe the most, the best hair metal band. Let's put it that way.
All right, David, last Twitter question for this episode. Are you glad Guns N' Roses did a reunion tour?
So I've been thinking a lot about it, and we're recording this on Thursday. Tuesday was Duff McKagan's birthday. Yesterday was Axl Rose's birthday. I've been thinking a lot about Guns N' Roses. They are, you know, with Radiohead, Pearl Jam, Nine Inch Nails, probably my favorite band, the first band I saw in concert. And I think because I'm old, and I went to the reunion shows. I spent a lot of money. I went to the first show in Vegas. Like, that's how much of a fan I am. And I had a blast there. Then I saw them again at Gillette. And I always told anyone, if you never saw Guns N' Roses before, if you're younger or if in the 90s you didn't go, you absolutely should go to the reunion. But, you know, now that I'm getting older and I think a lot about legacy and how people are remembered and all, I have to say maybe I'm kind of... Part of me wishes they'd never done the reunion because, you know, it really changes the way I view them. I've been watching a lot of videos of Guns N' Roses in their prime. And, you know, age obviously catches up to everyone. But I think especially Axl Rose, it's really caught up to him. And, you know, I saw him in his prime, was lucky enough to see two concerts in the 90s, one from really close. And in a way, it's kind of sad for me that that's no longer the image that I have of him. Like now when I think of him, I think of like this overweight guy with his voice almost gone. Like, I mean, I listened to his voice in the 90s compared to now. It's like night and day. So it's like part of me is like, it's kind of a shame that that image has been gone. Like, I've been, you know, watching like older videos from the 90s. And even when they did the Freddie Mercury tribute concert, when he was there, and it's like, geez, you know, maybe I'd rather just remember them that way. So it's pretty interesting. You know, I know there's some other rock stars, like his contemporaries, like Trent Reznor, Nine Inch Nails, Eddie Vedder. It just looks really good. It's not like when I go see Pearl Jam or Nine Inch Nails, do I feel that it's ruining my image of what them in the 90s? Like, actually, it kind of reinforces it. So I don't know. Maybe I'll change my mind again. So I want to thank all our listeners for great support this week. Thank you for sending the questions. Thank you for your reviews. I love getting the tweets on people promoting the podcast. We're a free podcast. We never ask you to contribute financially. We can always use your help growing with reviews and that. So thanks for your support. We're going to close the week with an interview with my dear friend Nima Tavalli on Inter. I was kind of worried because I had to record this on Tuesday. I've been really busy. And with Inter, things changed so rapidly that I was terrified so much would happen. So nothing in the interview changed. But I will add that Inter is in such crisis that one of their players on loan, Caramo at Bordeaux, was kicked off the team for insubordination. Basically, instead of going to practice, he was shopping in Paris. So you got to hand it to Inter. Even the players on loan are showing solidarity and going crazy. So as Nima said, hey, you can take the boy out of Inter, but you can't take Inter out of the boy. So I think you'll really enjoy this interview. We went in depth on Inter. So thanks for your support, and we look forward to chatting next week. And for the interview part of today's podcast, we've been wanting to talk about Inter with everything that's going on at the club there. So just a note, I am recording this with my dear friend Nima Tavalli, who you guys know from SempreInter.com, the best source of Inter news in English. He's also one of the hosts on Serie A Show, a new podcast that also features two other frequent guests on Calcioland. That's John Solano and Chloe Beresford. So I'm thrilled to be joined by Nima, but I will say this. I'm half terrified because we're recording this on Tuesday morning. We're going to post this on Thursday. And knowing Inter, so much could happen from now until then. So just keep in mind, as we're recording, we're doing this on Tuesday. So Nima, welcome back to Calcioland. Always a pleasure to have you on.
Good to be on. And as you so correctly noted, 48 hours in Inter time chronology is like 3 years. So there's so much can happen between now and Thursday.
Yeah, it's kind of like living in the United States with our president. Okay, so let's get started with this. So Inter, to me, had a great summer transfer window on paper, got off to a very good start to the season. The elimination in the Champions League, which when the draw happened, I think everyone kind of assumed they wouldn't get out of the group stage, but they got off such a good start. It was disappointing. And since then, things, I'd say, have taken a turn for the worse. So let's start simply here. What has been the most frustrating aspect for you about this recent Inter crisis?
It's the most frustrating aspect, in my opinion, is simply the fact that I was hoping that the mental fragility of this squad and this group of players was something that belongs to the past. You know, obviously going through December, they you know, usually Inter get their mid-season depression begins in December over Christmas and then January and then ends in February. This time Inter did really well in December. I mean, defeating Napoli in that game, being the icing on the cake. But then after that, you know, the January depression, Inter's annual January depression is something that Spalletti has improved it. I mean, December was good, as I said, but now it's still January, and it's unbelievable how every year, every January, Inter look like a team in complete shambles.
Okay, so it sounds like you are leaning a little bit more on the players, and I tend to agree there. But if you had to put a percentage between Spalletti and the players, kind of how do you break that up?
I mean, I remember I was on Calcioland this summer after the Nainggolan deal went through, and I remember I told you that, you know, this is a big risk that Spalletti's taking, because he's really, really weak. He wants Nainggolan so much. He's putting a lot of his prestige on the line. That is how, you know, and that has gone completely pear-shaped. It's not been good. Nainggolan has been one of the worst players into this season, and his what happened during the Christmas with that audio that leaked over Christmas, on Christmas Day, actually, causing him to be banned. All of that, I blame, you know, that is in that entire situation with Nainggolan is Spalletti's fault because he insisted on him. But when it comes to, so I'd say about 40% Spalletti, 60% the players, because at the end of the day, this group of players has been at Inter for almost 7-8 years now, most of them, obviously not the ones that Spalletti insisted on, but there is something in that dressing room that causes this thing to happen every single season. I mean, I saw a tweet thread about how Inter during January of 2012, and except for 16-17, it's been disastrous. 16-17, won 4 games, lost 1. Other than that, it's loss, draw. It's not good. And that is something that we can't blame on Spalletti, because since Inter have had almost a Zamparini level of a number of coaches since 2012, so it can't be just the coach. So I blame the players more, but Spalletti certainly, as the head coach, has a responsibility for sure.
Yep, I'm with you on the Nainggolan part, and you know we're friends, so I'm going to say this as kindly as I can. The Zaniolo thing has to really hurt to see him play this way, but I promise this will be the last time I bring him up on the podcast. So you know, you have on one hand Nainggolan, who looks like almost like a Finnish player, been a big distraction. On the other hand, you have Zaniolo, who looks like the next great Italian prospect. And it kind of reminds me, in some ways, in years past, Coutinho was constantly brought up as an example of Inter not being patient enough with players. So do you think there's the potential for the Zaniolo Nainggolan one to be even more annoying and a long-term thorn in the side for Interiste?
For me, this is Coutinho, I thought was necessary to get rid of, because he was never going to succeed at Inter in Italian football. For me, this is Pirlo. This is like Pirlo all over again. This really hurts, because you sent away Zaniolo, and you got Nainggolan, and this kind of really completes the circle, because when Inter wanted Hernanes, when chose to go after Hernanes instead of Nainggolan, they made the same mistake. This is Hernanes 2.0 all over again, that you're going for someone who's finished instead of going for the one that's up and coming. And that is something that, again, why I blame Spalletti more there, is because if you look at how Sunin have acted all around the transfer window and the club as a whole, they don't want big names like that. They want players that are coming up. And I think that has hurt Spalletti a lot, because Zaniolo is fantastic. I mean, he can play in all three midfield roles. He looks like a complete player, and he's just going to get improved with the years. So for me, this has got this kind of Pirlo vibe to it more than Coutinho.
Well said. I hadn't thought about that angle. So I promise that's the last time we're going to say the name of the player with the Z on the podcast, unless you bring it up. So let me ask you, you mentioned, the locker room and, the vibe on the team. So, Icardi, I'd be absolutely flabbergasted if he doesn't extend his contract with Inter. But in any event, it's been, pretty public negotiation on his side of things. Do you think that has been a bigger distraction than Perisic at the end of the transfer window demanding to be sold, probably knowing that the team he wanted to be sold to couldn't really make the type of offer that Inter could even accept? So which one of these two things do you think has been a bigger distraction overall?
I mean, when the captain of your team, when his agent goes out on national TV in Italy and says that the captain wanted to stay, but the directors wanted to send him away in the summer to Juventus in change of Higuain, she's basically throwing the entire club hierarchy under the bus there. And then what she did after that in Argentina, when Wanda goes and confirms to an Argentinian outlet that Icardi won't extend his contract, that breaks like a bomb. Then she walks that statement back. That, of course, has created... I mean, we're talking about the club captain, the symbol of the team. When he behaves like this, that has repercussions all over that dressing room. And Perisic, I can't blame Perisic for wanting to leave, because he wanted to leave already a year and a half ago, but Spalletti managed to convince him to stay. Both of them admit to this or confirm this. So there is no doubt in my mind that when your team captain behaves in this manner, it affects the dressing room. But I'm not saying that he's the sole person to blame or she's the sole person to blame. I just think that it's like a perfect storm brewing, and everyone has added to it. And the Icardis have most definitely added to this by creating this, as you so diplomatically call it, a public negotiation. It's embarrassing. It's like a reality show, and it shouldn't be handled that way.
Okay, so now let's go on a more hopeful topic. Looking at the current landscape of Inter's players, and look, let's not forget, they still are in third place. The real objective of the season was to get back to the Champions League. You know, they're in line to do that. But based on, you know, what's going on, which players give you the most hope that Inter can get out of this crisis fairly fast?
The fact that Keita Balde is coming back gives me a lot of hope, because I really like that player. I think he's a player that Inter should really do their best to keep. The fact that Icardi now is kind of, he's always been at his best when he's under pressure, because he simply doesn't seem to feel pressure. I think that Brozovic, despite everything, has been so stable. I mean, he's really developed and raised his game as a player. This is just, they will get through this. But they will get through it in the way that Marotta and Suning want them to get through it. And I got to say, of all the signings Inter have made, Beppe Marotta is the best one Inter have made in a very, very long time. I mean, this guy did hardly get a chance before, you know, they barely managed to put his name on the door before he was, you know, he had fires to attend to and put them out. And he's handled it brilliantly. He's so calm, he's so cool, he's so collected. You know, you have to remember, Inter aren't like Juventus. Inter are and naturally, generally very unstable and volatile club. Marotta's approach is to calm that down. He's very level-headed. He thinks very much before he talks. And that is the approach Suning wants to have. I mean, he's the polar opposite of the fiery character that is Walter Sabatini. So I think this is, you know, the way Marotta has handled all of this is simply fantastic. And I think Inter would be in a real crisis if Marotta wasn't there. But thankfully, he is there. And the way he's handled these situations is just brilliant, absolutely brilliant. So I think he will, the calm he spreads will is a big factor when Inter get out of this.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you there. I think, you know, Marotta is definitely a big part of Juve's success in a lot of ways. It really starts at the top. So now let's talk a little bit more about the coaching situation. You know, I'm with you. The players have been a big distraction. But, you know, if the results don't keep coming, it's not out of the question that we have, you know, coaching change. And we'll get to Conte in a second, but it doesn't sound like he wants to take over mid-season. Would you, though, in the interim, would you be open if, say, the results the next 2-3 matches don't go Inter's way, to bring in someone like Cambiasso, who I know has been mentioned, I'm not sure if this is true or not, but someone kind of like that to come in to give kind of the team a little jolt in the interim?
No, I don't want to burn out a legend like Cambiasso. I mean, Milan has done this, have gone down this road with the Inzaghis and with the Seedorf and you know, burning out club legends and sacking them. And I don't want to do that. Cambiasso and Mourinho are, you know, Cambiasso is my favorite player, I think, during, you know, my lifetime. I think he's too important to burn that bridge just yet. I honestly don't want them to do that. because I want him to take over. He, for me, he's like Walter Zenga. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't want them to sacrifice him at the altar, because I know that he would take it over. That is his dedication and love for the club. He would take it over in a heartbeat. And believe me, he would not stand for anyone not giving them all. But the thing is, I don't want to set another, you know, the precedent that's been set these past 7 years is when these players decide to not fight for a coach anymore, they're safe. Their contract, they're not the ones getting sacked. It's the coach that gets it. And I'm tired of it. I want these players to understand that there are consequences. And Marotta going out and defending Spalletti in this way and saying there's no issue and I haven't in my 22 years as a director never sacked a coach, that sends a really strong and important message. But sure, if Inter, you know, can lose 4 or 5 more games in the Champions League, you know, we're talking free fall here, and Inter fall into 5th, 6th place, and there's a real risk of missing a Champions League, then something has to be done. Then sure, maybe bring in Cambiasso until the end of the season. But we're talking in emergency, in case of emergency, break the glass kind of thing there.
Okay, so now let's go back to Antonio Conte, who, you know, I definitely think would see the Inter job as being really attractive, you know, not just because, you know, of the history of the club, also because of the potential spending on the transfer market. They also brought in Diego Godin for next season, so there's like the new making of a new BBC back there. But aside from all those factors, because of his past at Juve, how do you think the reaction would be at Inter if Antonio Conte is the manager next season?
Antonio Conte is a world-class manager. That's, I mean, in my opinion, in my opinion, his greatest masterpiece is what he did with the Italian national team, who was, in terms of quality, at an historical low, and he took them to penalties against world champions Germany in the Euros. I mean, that was, to me, that's a masterpiece. That just shows what a fantastic coach, what impact that, you know, a good coach has. I don't think Conte at Inter would work. You know, except for Trapattoni, Juve managers at Inter, it never ends well. I mean, Lippi was an unmitigated disaster. And he's a world-class coach as well. He was in a Conte. He was the equivalent of Conte back then, you could even say. I mean, Lippi had even won more than Conte at that point in his career. I think just the fact that the character of Conte, I don't think he would suit Inter at all. Again, Inter are a volatile club. Conte is a volatile personality. Him and Marotta already aren't exactly, they didn't exactly see eye to eye towards the end at Juve. And as I said, Juve are a much more stable club in their DNA. Inter aren't. I think that would, Conte would be, wouldn't, that wouldn't end well. Personally, if I don't understand why the Maldini and Leonardo don't just call Conte up and say, get over here, because that squad is just built for Conte, in my opinion. They have the wing backs, they can play the three-man defense, they have the midfielders. In my opinion, it's the dream job would be Milan. Inter should hang on to Spalletti if possible, and then Simeone should come in.
Mm. I like that. Okay, so now let's simply put, want to ask you this. So, you know, a few weeks ago, let's say a month ago, when Inter was eliminated in the Champions League, they were in a very good position in Serie A. You know, we know about Pazza Inter, but I think most people would have felt pretty confident that they would nail a Champions League spot for next season, which was the goal. But now, you know, things have changed a little bit. There's a lot of teams competing for that. So do you think Inter should still focus on the Europa League as well? Do you think they have enough depth, or would you rather they kind of take a Napoli approach and say, you know what, we might not be competing for the Scudetto like Napoli was last season, but our goal is to get back to the Champions League, period? Or do you think there's enough to compete on both fronts?
I think that's a great question, because it depends. I mean, at the beginning of the season when we spoke, I asked me what my goal is, what I think Inter should be aiming for. It's the same answer then as it is now. Spalletti's job was not to win titles, or the Serie A. His job is to stabilize Inter as a top 14, season after season. Last season, to finish fourth. If they can finish third this season, that's improvement. His goal was to get Inter through to the from the Champions League. He failed with that, but they were very close. It was just a Handanovic mistake against Tottenham in the first game away from qualifying on goal difference against a Tottenham who's been playing Champions League for the past 6-7 years. In terms of the Europa League, I think we can ask of them to go to the quarterfinals at least, minimum. Anything after that is a bonus. But the effort and the energy has to be put into the Serie A. There's no doubt about that in my mind. They have to finish third, not fourth, third. There has to be improvement. This is the Inter cannot go into qualify for the Champions League with the skin of the teeth like they did last season. It's just not, that's regress. That's not progress. They have to finish third. They have to do it comfortably. They have to do it without the drama. That is what Spalletti has to do. And I think that is why a lot of this, these rumors about him getting sacked have come out, because that was the objective. The objective, you know, the Coppa Italia semi-final minimum. He failed at that after, you know, so that's two season objectives failed now. He's got two left, quarterfinal, semifinal of the Europa League, but above all, third in the Serie A. That's incredibly important, because that also sends a message in terms of mental development and psychological development to this team, that they can grow, because they finished fourth before, but then after that, the season after that, they crashed. They need to break this mental barrier, and that's why that third place is so important.
Well said. I completely agree with you there. Okay, Nima. So you did fantastic work here. You produce some great content. I mentioned at the top, Sempre Inter is a great destination, the best place to get all your Inter news in English. So I know you guys also have the podcast, the Studio Inter, which is fantastic. So tell us a little bit what's going on the site and that podcast.
Yeah, we were so happy because we broke a barrier in 2018. We had over 1.2 million people visit the site in the calendar year, so we're very grateful and happy about that. We're going to continue developing the product, the site, you know, with more exclusive content. I mean, we've got the whole news reporting site locked down. Now it's more about exclusive content, such as, you know, we have a preview writer, Mohamed Nasser, who does excellent work. We have a stats preview. We have a medical student from LA who does all the medical reporting stuff and does his own analysis of that. So it's basically continuation of that stuff. People who are Inter fans, but also experts in their field, and we try to put Inter into that context, as well as try to produce more exclusive interviews and stuff like that. The podcast, we're going to continue doing. We've had you on. We've had some other of your colleagues on. We're going to continue, Marcotti, Horncastle. We're every week we go through everything there. So that's what we're going to do.
Fantastic. So in addition to that, I mentioned at the top, you also started another podcast with two friends of Calcioland, John Solano and Chloe Beresford. They're both excellent. And so you guys did the first episode of the Serie A show. So tell our listeners a little bit what they can hear if they tune in to Serie A show.
First of all, thanks a lot for that shout out. We're very, very grateful to you and everyone who's listened to it for the amazing response we've had. We've just done one episode and we're recording tonight. As you said, it's Tuesday. Basically, John has AS Roma Press. I have SempreInter.com. Chloe has, she writes a lot about Fiorentina. This was more, the idea behind this podcast was more kind of like a roundtable discussion between three Serie A and calcio nerds that talk stuff that maybe usually doesn't get the headline. So there's basically minimum transfer talk because we think, there's so much good content regarding that out there. I mean, this podcast, for sure. I mean, Calcioland and what you guys do is you're second to none when it comes to that area. So what we do is more like a little bit in depth, but without going too geeky. I mean, David, you've known me for 6-7 years. You know that I'm almost obsessed with Italian sporting directors and how they work. And now I have two other friends that are equally obsessed, and we can talk about stuff like that. So it's kind of like that. It's that level. It's more of a roundtable discussion about everything and anything, say, yeah, in culture.
Awesome. Well, Nima, it's always great to catch up with you. Thank you so much for recording this. So again, please note, we recorded this on Tuesday, which we'll play this on Thursday, and there's so much can change, but I did fantastic work. Definitely everyone should check out Sempre Inter, Serie A show, and I look forward to chatting with you again, Nima, because with Inter, there's always stuff to talk about. So I really appreciate you joining me today. Thank you so much.
Oh, always a pleasure, David, and keep up the great work you and Alex do.